Thank you, Tara. That's one of them bonuses you get from being sober. Get up and hug his pretty girls in front of everybody, and your wife don't say anything bad about it, you know? Terry, if you'll get with me after this meeting, I'll tell you about back when I was somebody. You know, it's great to be here. 35 years, I figured that out all by myself. You know, 70 roundups to a year, is, you know, I'm pretty good in math. Congratulations. It's really, it's a pleasure to be here on the 70th Mont Eagle Roundup. You know, it's always fun to see people that we met in Alcoholic Anonymous, and it's always fun to be a part of, and it's always fun to get back with those same people. And you know a little about kickoffs. Tonight is a kickoff, kind of. It's an opening meeting of this particular roundup. A few years back when I was in the National Football League, we were playing up in Buffalo, and we got ready to kick off, and this Weeb Eubank, our little short coach, got us all in a meeting, you know, and everybody's out there beating each other on the back and screaming and hollering, and finally quiets everybody down. And he says, "Now we're going to kick that ball to that rookie back there that's going to receive it. We're going to see what he's got." Well, they kicked the ball off, and the rookie almost caught the ball at the goal line, and he fumbled it, and it went back in the end zone, and he kind of sauntered back there and picked it up and darted through. Everybody on the football team ran 105 yards for a score. The Jets finally scored, got ready to kick off again. Everybody's over there in front of the beach, beating each other on the back and getting ready to go, and we finally quieted everybody down, and he said, "This time we're going to kick that damn ball away from that rookie back there." Of course, that rookie's name was O.J. Simpson, He's not running real fast today. I'm Larry Grantham, and I'm an alcoholic. Larry. It's because of these 12 steps of Alcoholic Anonymous and God's grace in my life and people like you all over the world that practice these principles in their life that helps keep me sober, and I'm very, very grateful for that. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank everybody, the committee and the people and the directors, and for inviting us up here. And, you know, it's always good to get out of Alabama. You know, we were fortunate this year, and we had a couple of times we had a chance to go to Alabama. One was over at the Mountaintop Roundup, and then we went down to Mobile. And some things happened at Mountaintop Roundup that we don't like to talk about. You know, they got that Factory Outlet Mall there close to that. And I think we're still getting the bills from those credit cards from that outing. But Peggy, my wife, in case you don't feel like you get part of the story tonight, it's the sketchy part of the story tonight, you don't get the details filled in, be here tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. I was in a blackout most of the time, and she knows the story a heck of a lot better than I do anyway. But I would like to introduce my wife, Peggy. But we were over at Mountaintop last year, and they went down to Boaz, and she found this shop that had Tabasco. That's all they had, was Tabasco ties and shirts, and had some silk underwear in there with Tabasco on it. She wanted to buy those for me, and I don't wear silk. You know, macho men and ex-pro football players, we don't wear silk drawers, you know. I mean, well, a lot was said about that over at Mountaintop during the course of the weekend, and a few weeks later we had an occasion to go to Mobile, and I got up behind the podium and gave my little deal, and when it was over with, the guy got up out of the audience and said, "This package arrived, and its instructions are that you got to open it up there behind the podium." And it was a pair of silk underwear with Tabasco all over. So I'm glad to get out of Alabama. I'm glad to get in Tennessee where people know that we don't do those kind of things. But I'm a native Mississippian on top of all that. And I, you know, until a few years ago, I didn't even know what a native Mississippian was. I thought you just had to be born there. And they said, no, a lot more qualifications than that. As a matter of fact, to be a native Mississippian, Mississippi is made up of 82 counties. And you got to have gotten drunk in all 82 counties. So I realize I'm a native Mississippian. And I grew up in central Mississippi, and all I can tell you about my childhood is it was a very, very happy childhood. I came from a family that had, we had six children in the family. We had three girls that were older, and then I came along as the oldest boy, and I got two younger brothers. When I got sober and I went back through this deal of why I'm an alcoholic, you know, we all want to know why, and the book don't have a chapter in it that says why we're alcoholic, right? But we all want to discover it anyway, and so I was trying to do this four-step and think about this, trying to figure out why I was an alcoholic, and I finally figured it out. You know, we grew up kind of poor, and I had to wear hand-me-downs to school, and with three older sisters, you know, that might have been one of the reasons, but I doubt if that's the reason I'm standing up here before y'all tonight. You know, really, I came from way out in the country. The town that we went to school in was Crystal Springs, Mississippi, and we were about 8 miles out in the country. We didn't have running water, and we didn't have indoor plumbing, and I didn't like that. So consequently, at an early part of my life, I set about trying to get out of the environment I was raised in. I was ashamed of where I was raised. And I really felt like that even though I came from a great home, my mother and dad were all good to us, and we didn't have a lot, but we didn't go wanting for anything we had to have. And even with that large family, my dad worked hard, and we went to church, Southern Baptist Church, you know, and we were there. I think old Jim Debbie out of Texas says a real, real, real Southern Baptist. Because we even prayed for the Catholics, you know, so. But we were there every time the church doors were open, and that was okay with me at that time. And I even walked aisles at church when I was 13 years old, and I got baptized in the fellowship of the church. But nothing changed in my life because I didn't make any changes, and, you know, I just went on with my life. But I felt like I had a little bit of athletic ability. So to get out of that environment that I was raised in, I really started working at what little ability I had. And my dad was a disciplinarian in the family, and the only requirement he had was he said that all his children were average students or better. So as long as we didn't want to do anything except go to school, we could make average grades, C's, A's, and B's. But he said, if you're going to participate in any curricular, other extracurricular stuff at school, if you're going to play sports or be in a band or cheerlead or do anything else, you got to make the honor roll because you could spend that time studying otherwise. So he required us to make the honor roll, and sure enough, I made the honor roll, and I did fairly well in school. And when I got to be a senior in high school, the University of Mississippi over here, Ole Miss, who's playing them Georgia Bulldogs tomorrow on television about the time my wife talks. I wouldn't touch that again, I tell you. But anyway, Ole Miss over here, we used to call it the Country Club of the South. They came down and they offered me a scholarship to go up there to play football and baseball. Well, you know, when I left home and went up there, it was 200 miles away from my hometown, and I felt like I was on my own, and I had some primary purposes in my life when I got there. You see, I wanted to learn about alcohol. Because I felt like the man of the world, the macho man, the person I wanted to become, needed to learn about drinking, needed to learn about alcohol. And, you know, by then I had kind of figured out that I was born with some character defects. Didn't really amount to much, but you know, I'd climb a tree to tell a lie rather than stand on the ground and tell the truth, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't know how to tell you all about my character defects. I'll tell you this quick story by Jerry Clough with the Mouth of the South told his story, and he really tells it a lot better than I do, but he's not here tonight, so I'm going to tell his story. He talked about the young 10-year-old kid that was sitting out on the out in the country where the two old dusty roads cross, you know, and the kid was sitting out there, and it was dead summertime, July, hot, dusty. And all at once, this big electric 225 pulled up there, and the guy stopped to get a soda pop, and It had a license plate on it, you know, like maybe in New York or somewhere, probably a Yankee. And the guy was going in the store to get a soda pop, so he decided he'd have some fun with that kid sitting there. And he looked over there, and there's a watermelon over there, and he pointed over there and said, "Son, I bet you can't eat that whole watermelon." That kid looked at that watermelon, looked at that man, and said, "I don't know, mister, that's a big watermelon." He said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." The man said, "I'll tell you what I'll do, son. If you'll eat that whole watermelon, I'll give you this $10 bill. That kid eyed that $10 bill and eyed that watermelon. He said, "I don't know, it's pretty big, mister. But if you'll wait right here," so "I'll be right on back." He took off up the road to a house about 300 yards up that old dusty road, kicking up the dust with his heels. And about 20 minutes later, he come running back down that road. He said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir, mister. I can eat that watermelon." He sat down and ate the whole watermelon, seeds, rinds, the whole deal, you know. That man said, "Well, son, I'm going to give you this $10 bill, but you got to tell me why you had to go up that house up there and before you could tell me where you could eat it or not." He said, "Well, mister, that was a big watermelon. I really wasn't sure." He said, "You know, we had one under the bed at the house up there about the same size. And I knew if I could eat that up there, I could eat this one down here." So that's kind of the way it was when I was a kid. I just never did get enough of the good stuff, you know. But I rocked along there, and I signed to go to Ole Miss. And I had some primary purposes in my life when I got to Oxford, Mississippi, 200 miles away from home and 200 miles away from any discipline in my life. And I figured it out. First time we had any spare time, any off time, I got with the upper class and the older football players. They knew the ropes. And we left Oxford, Mississippi, and went 90 miles north to Memphis, Tennessee. We were going over into West Memphis, Arkansas. That's when they had them old joints over there. Milton had that plantation inn and had all them good places over there. We stopped on Lamar Avenue, which the highway going into Memphis becomes Lamar Avenue. And we stopped at the liquor store. And I went in the liquor store and I looked around. I had a limited budget. I didn't have much money with me. And I looked around. I didn't know the difference between beer and wine and whiskey or bourbon or gin or vodka or nothing. And I looked over there, and my eyes kind of fell on a gallon of Mogan David wine. So it fit in my budget, too, so I bought it. I went back out the car, and we had paper cups, and we had ice, and I put that ice in that paper cup, and I poured that Mogan David wine over it, and I drank it right on down. Well, I filled it back up, put some more ice in it, and drank that right on down. I can't tell you everything that happened that night. But I know the next day, when I came to, I do recall that now, some 40 years later now, I know that all the classic symptoms of alcoholism was present in my life the first time I drank alcohol. You see, the book told me when I got sober and when I found out what the book had to say, it said men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I certainly didn't drink that Mogan David wine because of the taste. I liked what it did for me. And then I found out later that the definition of alcoholic that I like is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard people say there are no definitions in the big book. They're only descriptions. I believe the phrase that says alcoholics are men and women who's lost the ability to control their drinking is find a description of alcoholic as you can have. Because that night I could not control the amount of alcohol I put in my body once I started drinking. And then everything else that happened that night was all that happened to me for 30 years of drinking. I went into a blackout, I got in trouble, and I passed out. And after I got sober, I figured out those are the symptoms of alcoholism. But I didn't come to the next day and say, "I better go over at the old Harbor House that my friend Bill back there runs down at Oxford and check myself in because I'm an alcoholic." I was 17 and a half years old. And I got up the next day and I had a hangover and I said, "I ain't doing that no more." But it was a wine, see, that got me. I ain't going off with them old football players no more, you know. I identified what I thought was the problem. But I made a decision. Damn near killed me, but I made a decision. I could drink alcohol if I didn't drink Mogan David wine, and if I only drank a certain amount. But 30 years later, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still trying to figure this thing out for myself, you know. But I had a good 4 years while I was in college. Ole Miss was in its heyday, had tremendous football teams, and my curriculum consisted of football, drinking, and girls, and I'm not sure what had priorities in there, you know, where the priorities were. Some people say I was the only person who went to Ole Miss 4 years and got out totally untouched by a college education. But we had a lot of good times. We had a lot of good football teams. In the 3 years we were eligible to play varsity football, we went to the Sugar Bowl twice at the end of the season and the Gator Bowl once. So we played in three bowl games at the end of the season as a reward for having good years. My senior year at Ole Miss was 1959. We played 11 ball games. And back in those days, played offense and defense. And we scored 327 points in 11 ball games. We gave up 21 points in 11 ball games. That team was voted the team of the decade in the Southeastern Conference. And, you know, I've had the privilege of making All-American, All-Conference, and all this stuff. And, oh, yeah, and I dated two Miss Americas while I was down there. Now, that ain't got nothing to do with football or drinking. I just want y'all to know it, see? Finally, in 1960, my phone started ringing. Baltimore called and said I'd been drafted to play pro football in Baltimore with the Baltimore Colts. And then New York called and said I'd been drafted by the American Football League team in New York to play pro football in New York. Well, I don't know where most of y'all probably, some of y'all are old enough to remember Andy Griffith. Andy Griffith had a record out about this time, and it's what it was football. At the end of the record, he finally figured the game out. He said he finally figured out the purpose of the game was to make it from one end of that cow pasture to the other without either falling down or stepping in something. And that's about all I knew about pro football. I mean, we didn't have pro football teams in the South. The TV was so bad at the snow, we called it, you couldn't see anything except a little image there on the screen. So I'd never seen a professional football game. But these people came to Oxford, Mississippi, and they started piling some money up there on the table, and they started calling it a bonus to sign your name. Nobody had ever offered me any money to sign my name before. When they got up to $1,000, I asked them where in the hell I signed, you know, because I'd never seen $1,000 in one pile in my life. And I signed that contract and took off to play pro football in New York City. Now, I want to tell y'all, I wish we were all going to stay sober the rest of our lives, but unfortunately, some of us might not. But if you hadn't found if where you live and how you drank and the places you drank in, if they don't serve it as like you like it served, as long as you like it served, as fast as you like it served, you might ought to try New York City. Them places up there, buddy, I'm going to tell you. But for the next 13 years, I pursued a career that could only possibly have happened in my dreams. You know, when you're standing underneath the goalpost at Shea Stadium out on Long Island there, Sunday afternoon, and you're introduced as a starting right linebacker of the New York Jets football team, 62,500 screaming fans in the stands, knowing that you're on TV, being watched by millions, knowing that when you go down to the city in New York City, the cab drivers all asking you for your autograph, going in these restaurant and bars and being recognized and people buying you dinner and buying you booze. And, you know, it just kind of does something for your ego, you know. There are a lot of funny things that happen in football. I remember one day out in the middle of the game, oh, we were playing the Chicago Bears. They had this guy named Dick Butkus, one of the most famous linebackers of all time. He looked over the line of scrimmage there, and he looked at our little offensive end, little old Don Maynard, and he said, "Maynard, you come back across this middle and catch a pass, I'm going to bite your head off." Maynard looked at him and said, "Butkus, if you bite my head off, you'll have more brains in your stomach than you got in your head." It was all that kind of stuff for 13 years, you know. My third year in pro football, it got about this time of year, Thanksgiving. My dad had died in 1961, and about 1963, Thanksgiving, I decided it's time to bring my mother to New York City. Mother had never been on an airplane, and she'd never been to a pro football game. And I thought it was time for me to fly her to New York, because you see, at Thanksgiving, here, I know what we do. We make cornbread dressing. Well, in New York, they don't make cornbread dressing. They make white bread dressing. And I've been up there 2 or 3 years, and I was tired of that, so I decided to fly Mother up there so she could make some cornbread dressing. Mama got off that airplane. She had a pan about this big around. She was going to make dressing for everybody on the football team. But by then, my drinking had started to escalate quite a bit. My dad had been the disciplinarian, and he had passed away. So I thought I'd better kind of prepare Mother. So on the way home from the airport that day, I said, Mother, you know, by then we had this sponsor named Rheingold Beer. It's a local beer company up there, and they sponsor the games on TV. And they told all the players, that now we're going to send you 2 cases of beer a week, regardless where you want it or not. If you need more, let us know. We'll send more out to your house. So on the way home, I decided I better talk to Mother. And I said, Mother, I'm the lightest linebacker in professional football. Matter of fact, throughout the year, my weight has a tendency to just drop off of me. And I got to keep my weight up. The team wants me to stay kind of heavy. Matter of fact, they've suggested I drink some beer to kind of keep my weight up, you know. Mother didn't say anything, and we drove on out to where we lived. And we lived in an apartment complex with about 4 other football players. And that day, no, it was 8 other football players there, 7 others. And that day, Rheingold had delivered 16 cases of beer to my place, 2 cases for every football player that lived out there, and they'd stacked it all in my foyer. We walked in, and Mother took one look at that beer. She said, Son, how much weight they want you to gain? But we rocked along there. If you remember the history of pro football, you know, the American Football League was over here. It was brand new. Started in 1960. The American Football League started in 1919. So in 1960, it was about 41 years old. And they hated each other. The 2 distinct leagues, for the first few years, they hated each other, they fought each other, they drafted players, mutual draft, both of them had drafted a player and tried to sign him and get a man to jump from one team over to the other league, and they hated each other. And finally, in 1967, they got smart. They decided they'd play 1 game between the National Football League, the old established league, and American Football League, the young league, for the championship of professional football. And they call it, somebody coined the phrase, Super Bowl. So Super Bowl I was played in January of 1967. Green Bay won the National Football League title. Kansas City Chiefs won the American Football League title. They played in the first Super Bowl. Green Bay beat the hell out of them. January of 68 came around. Again, Green Bay won the National Football League championship. This time, the Oakland Raiders won the American Football League championship. They played in Super Bowl II. Again, Green Bay beat the hell out of them. So the National Football League was 2-0 by large margins. Finally, in December of 1968, the New York Jets played the Oakland Raiders in Shea Stadium in New York for the championship of the American Football League and for the right to go to Super Bowl III. We beat the Raiders that afternoon 27-23 in a tough, real tough ball game. That same day, Baltimore and Cleveland played in Cleveland for the championship of the National Football League and for the right to go to Super Bowl III. And Baltimore beat Cleveland 34-0 in their championship game. So Super Bowl III was going to be paired the New York Jets against the Baltimore Colts. And by the way, Peg and I just got an invitation to come back up to Baltimore. To Maryland for the Maryland State Convention next year. Don't you know we're going to have a hell of a good time up there? But anyway, it was going to be the Baltimore Colts and the New York Jets in Super Bowl III. And all the odds makers and all the smart people and all the money and everything, they decided we were 19, the Jets were 19 and a half point underdogs to Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. Well, I'm sure y'all know what our ego told us about that. But our young, illustrious quarterback named Joe Namath, he's out of Alabama over here by way of Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. He got up behind a roster, a podium such as this a couple of nights before the Super Bowl was going to be played. And some heckler in the back row said, "Oh, Joe, why don't you sit down and shut up? Baltimore's going to kick your butt on Sunday." And right off the top of his head, Joe said, "No, partner, you got it wrong. The Jets are going to win the game, I guarantee it." And it, you know, became the game that Joe Namath guaranteed we was going to win. And sure enough, we went out this Sunday afternoon and we beat Baltimore 16-7. We became the first American Football League team to ever win a Super Bowl. And things started happening in my life right away. We changed the history of pro football. They merged the two leagues, and now we know them as the National Football Conference and American Football Conference. And without our victory over the Baltimore, they probably would have quit playing the Super Bowls had it been as lopsided as the first two were. So we changed the history of the league. And the day after the Super Bowl, things started happening in my life. We went back to New York City. And we had a ticker tape parade like the Yankees had this year for the World Series down Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue. And we were in open-air convertibles, and people were throwing that confetti down on us, the most high-rise office buildings. And my mind told me, it don't get no better than this. I have arrived. I have proved to those people back in that hometown down there in Crystal Springs, Mississippi, that I can make something out of my life. I have proved that I could be somebody. Sure enough, my hometown, on January the 23rd, that same year, had a Larry Grantham Day. And they honored me and my family, and they had a parade and a banquet. And the governor of the state of Mississippi proclaimed it Larry Grantham Day. And the mayor and the board of aldermen in my hometown issued another proclamation. And again, my mind told me it don't get no better than this. I have arrived. I have proved I could do something with my life. I have proved to those people I could be somebody. Well, that was 1969. I continued to play pro football in 1973. I was 35 years old. I'd made All-Pro seven times, played in seven All-Star games. And it became time for me to retire from pro football. And I went back to that hometown where I built a home, where I had a wife and two children, where we were involved in all the community affairs and all the activities and trying to be good citizens. By 1975, I became a town drunk in that same hometown that I grew up in. I'm not proud of that tonight. I'm not up here bragging about that, but I got to tell you how it was. I couldn't get a job, and I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't pay my bills, or I wouldn't pay my bills. My life started going downhill so fast, and I didn't have anything at all to hang on to. Finally, in 1980, in 1975, the state of Mississippi took my driver's license, asked me to quit driving on their streets and highways. And of course, you know, as long as you had that Super Bowl ring on your finger, you didn't need a driver's license. Because all the cops down there seemed to like football, and when they stopped you, you just talked a little football and they let you go. So I didn't go to jail. But I kept driving, and I didn't have any driver's license. 1980, my wife of 21 years, we'd been married 21 years, filed for divorce in that same hometown we'd grown up in. She was a childhood sweetheart of mine. And the reason she put on that divorce petition was chronic alcoholism. Well, I'm sure y'all know what my attitude was about that. I might have been an alcoholic, but I damn sure wasn't chronic, you know. Things were happening so fast in my life. I was losing everything. My house that I'd built and paid for while I was playing football, I'd borrowed some money on it, and the bank come and repossessed it. All those cars, all those bank accounts, everything that I'd accumulated started to disappear. Finally, in 1980, I decided it's time to make a geographic change, I guess you'd say. Maybe it could have been unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. There was a lot going on down there. But I decided to move to Memphis, Tennessee. I packed up everything that I thought that was near and dear to my heart in the trunk of an automobile and drove across state line to Memphis. Well, I got to Memphis, and I found out pretty quick Memphis got the dumbest cops I'd ever been around in my life. They'd stop me, and I'd show them that Super Bowl ring, and they'd say, "No, we need to see a driver's license." I said, man, that ain't how it works. They started taking me to jail. Took me about 10 years to figure it out, Milton. Memphis is a basketball town, you know? Hell. But my jail time became a lot more frequent, and I just kept going to jail. You know, when you're driving all the time and you're wrecking cars and drunk all the time and you don't have a driver's license, you just wind up in jail. That's about really the place we ought to be. But you know, my drinking pattern, I don't know, I've thought about it a lot of times. Peggy can probably tell you a better pattern, but I drank what I wanted to drink when I wanted to drink it. And that was most of the time, because you see, I deserved it. Nobody had been to places that I'd been. Nobody that I knew had hung out in New York City and played pro football and done the things I could have done, so nobody could talk to me about my drinking. They couldn't talk to me about my bad checks. Once I gave them a bad check, it was their problem, you know. But that's the way I drank. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd come to in the mornings at about 8 o'clock. Peggy left to go to work about 5 minutes too late. Oh, yeah, and I did meet Peggy after I got up there. And I was really attracted to her. You see, she had a car and a job and a roof over her head and all these things that I needed. So we set up some light housekeeping. But she'd get up and go to work at 8 o'clock, 5 minutes too late. And I'd come to, and I'd look out there to make sure that old beat-up car got home. And I'd see if there's any new dents in it, any fresh blood on it. And I'd go back there to back with them good intentions. And I'd get me a cup of coffee. And when you can't hold that coffee without something poured in there, I'd pour something in there. And then I'd drink that. And there are two or three of those. I'd leave the coffee off and go straight to the source. And then all them good intentions I had was gone for the day. I mean, I was always going to get a job. I was always going to fill out an application for a job or call somebody or try to sell something. But I had all these good intentions. But I always got up and I had to have that drink first, because when you shake as bad as I shook, you just couldn't jump out of bed and go get on that phone, you know. So I drank what I wanted to drink. And I came home just about time to pass out. Most nights I made it pretty well home before I passed out. Some nights I didn't make it home. But Peggy and I had set up that light housekeeping, and finally in 1985, at the very darkest throes of my drinking, I did what a good alcoholic will do. I talked her into marrying me. Hell, she's about to leave me, so I figured if I get that piece of paper, then I still got that roof over my head, and she's got a job and a car, and a little money left, and so we got married. That was September 20th, 1985. Finally, on May the 26th of 1986, May the 25th of 1986, I was coming up Winchester Avenue there in Memphis, Tennessee. It was late on Saturday afternoon, and I'd been drunk for, you pick a number. I don't know. I'd been drunk for a while. I was trying to make it home, and it was raining. I doubt the rain had very much to do with the rest of my story. But I was in one of those old cars that you see around a lot of our meetings. We call them drunk cars, or I heard somebody call them whiskey-bent cars. If you don't know what it was like, I'll tell you. Mine was a basic blue car, but it had a green fender over here and a red fender on the front and rusted out places, you know, all through it. And you had to have baling wire to tie down the trunk and the hood, at least they fly up while you're driving, you know. It's about a $100 car. I doubt if Milton would even give me $100 for it. But I was coming up Winchester Avenue that afternoon, and some idiot up there, four cars in front of me, decided to make an illegal left turn. And, you know, I knew he was an idiot because I got a sign up there that says, no left turn. And, you know, us football players, we're not like we seem. You know, when we come out of college, we got a choice. We can either go into rocket science or pro football, you know, whichever one turns us on. Y'all probably think that all we can do is play football, old dumb football players, right? Well, I got news for you. We got other things we could pursue, you know. To show you how smart we are, is two of them were coming back out of New York after football season's over one year, and they were driving to Texas. And they were coming through Ohio, and the guy that owned the car got sleepy. So he got in the back seat and went to sleep. The other guy just kept driving. About 3 hours later, old Curly woke up and said, hey, Verlin, where are we? Verlin said, damn if I know. He said, well, you're driving. You hadn't got us lost or anything, have you, man? You ought to know where you're at. Verlin said, I don't know. He said, I saw a sign back there that said toodly-doo a little while ago. Curly said, toodly-doo, man. He got up, wiped his sleep out of his eyes, got up there in the front seat and sat there. And he said, Verlin, you done got us lost, man. And finally looked at me and saw a sign that said Toledo, Ohio, 5 miles. Toodly-doo, you know. So see, pro football players, they can go into rocket science or professional football, if, you know, whichever turns us on. So I was smarter than those people. That guy up there, 4 cars in front of me, was going to make an illegal left turn, and the sign says, no left turn. Now, that's dumb, you know. So everybody else stopped, and I didn't stop. The cops came, and I was a rear car in a 5-car pileup, and they said it was my fault. You know, I've worried about that a lot since then. But anyway, they came and they wanted to see a driver's license. I showed them that Super Bowl ring and they said, nah. Got to see a driver's license. Then they started talking to me about taking a test and I said, no, I don't do well on tests, so I better not do that. So I went down to Shelby County Drunk Tank one more time. That wasn't my first trip. I wasn't a rookie at going to jail. And I'm here to share with you tonight, if you've only been to jail once or twice, keep going, because it gets easier. You know, the first time you go, you got all that fear of the unknown and not, you don't know what you're going to do. And well, after you go a few times, it gets a lot easier. You just go in there and they take your fingerprints, take your picture, throw you in a drunk tank. And that night I did what I'd always done. After they threw me in that drunk tank, after they take my picture, my fingerprints and all this stuff, they put me in there, and that drunk tank in Shelby County's got a big old concrete seat that goes all the way around it. It's kind of a round drunk tank. And I claimed me about 5 or 6 feet of that concrete seat and laid down and passed out. That's what us drunks do. You can't go to sleep. I mean, you know, you can't wake up. You ain't been asleep, so you must have just passed out. And so I passed out, and I came to early the next morning. And I looked across the jail cell, and there was about 5 or 6 people over in a circle. Men, and they were talking. And I was really attracted to those men. You see, they were smoking, and I'd run out of cigarettes the night before. So I decided I'd go over and bum me a cigarette. And on the way over, I decided I better tell them how dumb the cops were, because I was sure that they would probably recognize an ex-National Football League linebacker. And that's not where we're supposed to hang out, it's in jail. And I had to tell them how dumb the cops were because I wasn't supposed to be in jail. And as quick as they found out who they had, they're probably going to let me go. And then I figured out I might ought to try to help these people with their lives because it looked like their lives were all screwed up. They were in jail. Didn't dawn on me that I was there with them, you know. But you always get a lot of free advice in jail. I don't know how many of y'all have been in jail, but you know, why we lock up all these lawyers? Everybody in there is going to tell you how to beat your case, and they can't even get themselves out of jail, you know? But anyway, I walked over and talked to those people, and after I gave out the things to talk to them about me, I started talking about them. And they said, we live on the streets of whatever town we happen to be in. We work long enough or steal enough to get a bottle, and we drink it. And we pass out in doorways or abandoned cars or under overpasses, wherever we happen to be. That's all we want to do with our life. That's our choice. Then they shared with me that they were in a drunk tank for public drunk. It's going to be a small fine, and they'd get out of there the next morning, and they'd be on their way, and they were going to move out of Memphis because the cops in Memphis, Tennessee, had got too tough on public drunk. And just out of curiosity, I asked them, I said, where will y'all go? Oh, we'll go to Little Rock, Arkansas. How will you get there? Oh, we'll probably hitchhike. How long will it take you? Oh, 10 days, 2 weeks. You know, to this day, I've tried to figure this thing out, and I don't know what triggered my mind. But after that conversation with those people, I went back and sat down on that seat I'd slept on the night before. And my life flashed before my eyes like a VCR tape. I saw where I was as a child, all the hopes and ambitions and dreams that I'd had. I saw where I was in college. I saw how I totally misused a college education. I saw all the things that happened to me in professional sport, in football, and how I'd gone to supposedly the pinnacle of success in pro football. And I saw all the opportunities I'd blown, and I saw all the things that happened in my life. And these people had told me that they were living a life that was their choice. And I asked myself one simple question: is this your choice? And of course, the obvious answer was no. The book talks about this, and they call it the moment of truth, the moment of clarity. Well, that morning in that jail cell, I knew I couldn't drink alcohol anymore. I finally had the ability to put alcohol into my problems for the first time in my life. You see, up at that point in time, alcohol was always an answer to me. It was always my friend. It never was a problem. It was always a solution. But that morning, I knew that I couldn't drink alcohol anymore, but I knew the moment I got out of there and left my own devices, I was going to drink alcohol. I didn't know anything else. I'd been in jail many times. Every time I'd come out of jail, I'd always gone to the nearest bar. I'd always picked up something to drink on the way home. I'd always had to have that alcohol. But this particular time, I knew I couldn't drink alcohol anymore, but I knew I was going to drink alcohol anymore. And that's the dilemma that the book talks about. I knew that alcohol had abandoned me, and I don't know where you are or where you will be or where you were. But when alcohol abandons you, it don't matter where you've been drinking Crown Royal or Chevy's Regal or that old jug we was talking about earlier, Jim, or Rub-A-Dub. You're probably going to have to do what I did. And I got out on my knees in that jail cell and I said, God, help me. It's the only sincere prayer I'd ever prayed as an adult. Oh, I'd prayed those prayers. Oh, God, if you get me out of this, I'll never do it again. But I certainly didn't mean my part of it. I don't know what God had for his part of it. But that morning in that jail cell, I was as sincere as I've ever been in my life. You see, I didn't have any more scams to pull on God. You see, I had pulled every scam I possibly could. I had no more bargaining chips. It was a straight-up deal. I don't know what I expected with my grandiose ideas about life. With my little bit of religious background, I probably felt like God was going to zap those doors, those cell doors with lightning and let me walk out of there a free man, never to drink again. That wasn't the way it happened. I had to get a bail bondsman like everybody else. But I got out of there and I knew something had changed in my life. Peggy had gone home to her folks that weekend and she'll tell you more about it when she gets back, because you see, this is a family disease. Peggy had been affected by my drinking just as much as I had been affected by my drinking. My daughter and my son both have been affected by my drinking. They don't believe it. They won't acknowledge it. They won't accept it. Peggy accepts it and acknowledges the fact that she has been affected by my drinking. And that's the only thing she suffers from today is acute Al-Anon. She got that black belt. But she came home that morning, that Sunday afternoon, and neither one of us had ever been around AA, had never been exposed to any AA, hadn't had sense enough to call AA, as a matter of fact. And she came in and I said, I told her my story, what had happened, and I said, I think I need some help. Never been around Al-Anon. I don't even know if she knew anybody in Al-Anon, but she said those magic words: Larry, if you need help, you'll find it. The phone book is full of people that can help you, but I can't help you. And isn't that the way it is? Alcoholic Anonymous was started years ago by one man sitting down sharing his experience, strength, and hope with another drunk, that they might both recover from alcoholism. And that's all Alcoholic Anonymous is today. And that's all Alcoholic Anonymous will ever be in the future, is one drunk sharing with another drunk. We try to make it a lot of other things. We go to a lot of meetings and they got AA up on the board, but it sure don't look sound like AA to me. One drunk talking to another drunk, and that's Alcoholic Anonymous. She said those words and she'd never been around, and she said, Larry, I can't help you, but there's phone books full of people that can help you. Well, I made it through that night, and I don't know how I made it. I didn't drink. Probably didn't have anything to drink in the house. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. I don't know. I shook pretty bad. Had the sweats and the fevers and all this stuff. Came to the next morning. She went to work like she always does. She's got pretty good work here, ethics and work habits. And it's Monday morning, and she went to work, and I called her at work, and I said, "Well, I guess you didn't hear me yesterday. I need some help." And again, she said those words, "If you need help, you'll find it." You see, all my adult life, ever since I found out I could play a little football, all I had to do was snap my fingers, and I always had somebody running to my rescue. And this time, I'd run out of people. I'd run out of everything. The last time I'd gotten in jail, Peg had called my brothers and told them to come get me out of jail, and they said, "No, we got him out last time. Why don't you get him out this time?" All my family turned their backs on me, and Peggy was fast turning her back on me, and I had nobody left. I had nobody, no friends. I used all the JET organization. I'd used up everybody around me. And Peggy told me those words, and I didn't know what to do. And finally, I remembered, and my mind played a trick on me, y'all. I don't know what y'all do if you're watching TV and they start talking about getting sober and you're drinking. I fast forward to another station. But I did remember that Monday morning a phone number from a treatment or a detox center over in Brinkley, Arkansas. Now that's 75 miles west of Memphis, y'all, and I had never been to Brinkley, Arkansas in my life. But I had sense enough to dial that phone number that morning. And I got a recovering alcoholic on the other end of the phone, and he said, "If you'll hang around and be in your living room at 2:30, we'll be in your living room and I will meet you there. And don't drink to Lynn." And I didn't drink till then. They showed up at 2:30. Within a short period of time, they pissed me off. We sat there, and they started telling me how they drank. And I kept telling them my problems. You see, I'd call them. They were supposed to come over and fix my problems. And they started telling me about how they drank. And then they'd tell me some more about how they drank. And then they'd tell me some more about staying sober. And finally, after several hours of this, I did realize that we both knew about drinking. But they knew about staying sober, and I didn't have a clue about staying sober. And I was attracted to those folks. And isn't that what Alcoholics Anonymous is, a program of attraction rather than promotion? We don't have to promote Alcoholics Anonymous. All we got to do is live this big book. And these rooms would be more full than we could ever hope for. But I was attracted to those folks, and I'd have followed them anywhere they were going. Thank God they only went going back over to Brinkley, Arkansas. And I went with them, and I checked myself into a 14-day detox program. All we did was get detoxed and study the book and talk about the book and read the book and hear old Joe and Charlie Big Book study tapes and try to study the book. Except they had a psychiatrist there. I hope I don't step on anybody's toes. You know, I've always had psychiatry up there pretty close to witchcraft. And the reason being is, when I went back to football every July, back to pro football in New York, the first thing you had to do, you had to sit down with a psychologist, and prove to them that you hadn't become a killer from the year before. All they want is cripplers. They don't want killers. You know, if you picked up a paper Sunday morning or Monday morning and it said 8 National Football League quarterbacks killed in the line of duty, that wouldn't work. So they want you to cripple them up and put them in the hospital, but they don't want you to kill nobody. So every year you'd go back and you had to talk to the psychiatrist and prove to him that you were just a crippler. "Oh, I'm going to cripple up that other team, but we ain't going to kill nobody this year," you know. And I've been able to do that for 13 years, so I didn't have much faith in psychiatrists. And I never told one of them the truth anyway. And if you don't tell them the truth, I doubt they can help you very much. But anyway, we had to go see a psychiatrist, and I'd go in there and I'd say, "David, how you doing? Fine, Larry, how you doing?" He'd say, "Tell me about your childhood." And I'd say, "I had a happy childhood." And we'd sit there and look at each other for about 20 minutes, and he'd say, "Get the hell out of my office." And I'd get out of his office, and I'd go right down the hall, and they had a big black man sitting there named Larry G. And he'd been sober 12 years at the time. And he'd gone through what they call the Little Rock Approach Plan in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he shared with me, and he told me what it took for him to get sober and stay sober. And he didn't give me any of those suggestions that we talk about so freely here in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me if I wanted to get sober and stay sober, here's what I was going to have to do. And he laid it out for me. He said, you're going to have to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you can sit on the periphery of Alcoholics Anonymous and die drunk. You always got involved in your drinking, so you're going to have to get involved in your own recovery. You're going to have to read the book, study the book. You're going to have to go to meetings. You're going to have to get your sponsor. You're going to have to make coffee and help set up those meetings. Get your home group where people know you. He told me the things that are very, very important to us drunks. I got out of there in 14 days, and I went back to Memphis, Tennessee. And the next move I made saved my life again. I went to some groups down in Whitehaven, South Haven area of Memphis, Tennessee. And I found those kind old men that we call old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me straight out, this is not hunky-dory Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want your life to be hunky-dory, they meet on up here up the street somewhere, but that ain't what this is. They told me I could be their group football expert. And when they got ready to talk about football, they'd call on me. Chad, I went to that group a lot of times. They ain't never talked about football. I hadn't got called on yet. Started talking about doing a four-step. I'd point that Super Bowl ring, and they said, nope, you got to do a four-step, you know. But they saved my life. They told me the truth. They assigned me one of those old-timers. I'm sure they assigned him to me because I wouldn't have picked him in a million years to be my sponsor. I mean, he's whatever macho pro football player needs for a sponsor. He's a little old flower man about that tall. He had just celebrated his 23rd anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me the truth. He told me them important things like, how important is it? Pretty damn important. I said, no, 100 years from now, nobody will know. I said, there's 8 billion Chinese over there, don't give a damn. But he told me also that he'd do my thinking for me for the first year. I said, I can't find that in the book. He said, well, he said, at least if I'm in charge of your thinking for the first year, it won't be in charge of a total, it won't be run by a total crazy person. And that made a lot of sense to me. But Jerry and I formed a bond that's unbelievable in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only sponsor I've ever had, and I love him dearly today. I got involved in those meetings. I got me a home group. I got Graceland over there, and Chet's been to Graceland. Milton's been to Graceland. A lot of people in this room have been to Graceland to our meeting. We read out of the original manuscript. We read how it works. We read the ABCs of how it works. And next Sunday says, if you're not convinced, you ought to reread the book to this point, or else throw it away. Then it says, being convinced, we're now at step three. Everybody talks about working the first two steps. I believe we get here with those first two steps. I believe I got here knowing that I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. And if I was powerless, I had to find some power in my life. But that's just what I believe. And I did those four steps, and I had to make those amends. I had to go to Peggy after I'd been sober for 2 years. And I had to tell Peggy that up until that point in my life, I didn't know anything about relationships. I didn't know anything about marriage. I didn't know anything about commitments. But if she was willing to start forward from right then and work from there forward, that we would try to work at this relationship. And today, Peggy is not only my best friend, she's my wife, and she got grandmother to eight grandkids here. I don't know where I'm a grandpa or not, but she's my best friend. She knows all about me. I don't have any secrets in our marriage today. She don't have any secrets for me. I had to go make amends to my brother. It was very painful amends. He lived in Vicksburg, Mississippi. You see, my brother was born clubfooted. He's 2 years younger than I am. He didn't have a big foot. His foot was turned completely around. And when he was young, through a series of operations, they broke his foot and broke it and broke it and kept it in a cast and kept it in a cast. And finally, they got it all straightened up and they built him an Achilles tendon, which he was missing when he was born. His toes had been turned around backwards. And when he got up in high school, he played high school athletics. And when I went to Ole Miss and he graduated from high school, he was a baseball pitcher and a football quarterback. And I made Ole Miss, I demanded that Ole Miss give him a scholarship to come up there and go to school. And you see, he didn't have a scholarship like I had. He didn't have a full free ride. He had to work in the cafeteria behind the lunchroom counter, and he had to live behind a gymnasium, and he had to scramble around and get his books, and he just got a little bit of financial aid was all he got, but I took credit for that. So when I got in the throes of my alcoholism, and I had to go, I got my finances in pretty bad shape, and he took advantage of the system, and he's a CPA, and an accountant, he's done well in life. So naturally, I had him co-sign some of them old notes for me, you know, Jim, and I defaulted on them notes, and he had to pay them off. And so when I got sober, I owed him a lot of money. But in my mind, I'd gotten his college education for him, so that was kind of a wash. I didn't really owe it to him. I put it down on that piece of paper, though. My sponsor and I was looking at that piece of paper called that four-step, and we were talking about it, and he said, "What about your brother?" And I told him what I perceived as the answer, that I'd helped him get his college education, and I didn't really think that, you know, that I owed him that money. He said, "Well, you put it down here on this piece of paper. Evidently it's bothering you." And he said, "You know, you're going to have to go make complete amends." You know, when a book says complete amends, it says direct amends in some places, it says complete amends in some places. And I believe direct amends means face to face. And I believe complete amends means if you owe a man $100, you pay him $100. You don't pay him 99.99. That's what I believe today. I didn't believe it back at the time. But I went down and saw my brother, and I made restitution. And I've been blessed for that. You know, Peggy and I have 8 grandkids. We have probably the most wonderful life that you could possibly dream. 2 years ago, we were doing one of these conferences down in Yazoo City, Mississippi. I was scheduled to do my deal on Friday night, and Peggy was doing hers Saturday. And we were notified by the New York Jet Organization that we were invited back to New York for a reunion. So I checked with the people in Yazoo City, and sure enough, I was scheduled Friday night. So I made arrangements to fly out there Saturday morning and fly to New York to go to this ball game and go to this reunion. And Peggy decided she needed to stay and fulfill her obligation. Well, I got one of my grandsons that lives 20 miles from the airport in Jackson, Mississippi. And we were in Yazoo City, which is 45 miles from the airport. So I had my daughter bring my 8-year-old grandson and meet me at the plane in Jackson, Mississippi. I flew to New York City for the weekend, just me and my grandson. We got up there and I got to carry him to that big famous toy store there, the biggest toy store in the world. And his eyes got about that big. Sunday, right prior to kickoff in the Meadowlands Stadium, they asked me to be an honorary captain that day, and I was down on the field. And I had my 8-year-old grandson with me. He had a camera, and he was taking pictures. And his eyes were about this big. There were stands full of people standing down on the floor at Meadowlands Stadium 2 minutes before the kickoff. You know, those kind of things happen once in a lifetime. If I'd have been drinking, my daughter wouldn't let me out of this state with my grandson, much less go to New York City. And if I'd have been drinking, I'd have certainly missed his eyes at the kickoff time. But those are just pluses from being sober in Alcoholic Anonymous. You see, that counselor over there in that treatment facility told me one thing. He said, "You're going to have to surrender to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic." And I didn't know anything about that. He said, "Surrender is the first step in recovery." He said, "If you don't surrender, you're probably not going to recover." He said, "You may have to compare this surrender to something that happened to you in your life." And I thought and thought and thought, and I knew I was a self-made man. I'd pulled myself up by my bootstraps from down there in that Mississippi, and I'd gone to the big city, and I'd played pro football, and I'd gone to the heights, and I had never surrendered to anything or anybody. Sometime on the football field, you know, we'd be behind 54 to 10, and they'd shoot the gun, and the game would be over with, and we'd go in the locker room, and we'd talk about, oh, we just run out of time. Hell, if we hadn't run out of time, it'd been 100 to 10, you know. But we couldn't surrender. We had to play the next week, and that's kind of the way my life was. It was instilled in me at an early age, you can do anything you want in this life as long as you're willing to work hard and sacrifice for it. And I didn't know about surrender. And this counselor told me over there I needed to kind of compare it to something that happened in my life, and I finally figured out there was one time, one person I'd probably surrendered to. The Miami Dolphins had this fullback named Larry Zonka. Now, Larry Zonka had number 39 on his jersey. If you don't believe it, I'll show it to you. He ran over me so damn many times, he tattooed his number on my chest, you know. He was a fullback, and I was a linebacker, and every time he got the ball, I was supposed to tackle him, and every time I tackled him, he ran over me and hurt me. It was just that simple. Finally, you know, they had him listed in the program at 235 pounds, but I know damn well his right leg weighed 235 pounds. I don't know what his total body weight was, but finally we went to an All-Star game in Houston, Texas, 1971, and we were going to work out all week and then get ready and then play the ball game and on Sunday, the following Sunday, and they put us in a room in a hotel together, Larry Zonka and our roommates. And all week long, we drank and played cards and chased women, and we didn't catch them women, but we chased the hell out of them. And finally, at the end of the week, I came to the conclusion he was just a good guy, a tough football player, just really a good guy. So I flew my wife and kids to Houston, Texas, and he flew his to Houston, Texas, and they sat in the stands together for the game. They got to be good friends. Very next year, we're playing the Dolphins down in the Orange Bowl. About September, Jets versus Dolphins. And old Bob Greasy, their quarterback, goes back to pass. We got this big old tall defensive end. He's in there on top of Greasy, and he's got his arms up. And they call it throwing out of a well, you know, and he's got to throw it up like this to get it up over. He's trying to throw the ball out there to Larry Zonka. He's come out on a little circle pattern over there on my side, and I'm back there backed up in the zone defense, and I see it all coming, and I got me a 15-yard running start. And I'm going to tattoo Larry Zonka. It's going to be payback for all them times he ever hit, run over me and hurt me, because I got him totally defenseless. He's looking back over his head trying to catch a pass, and I'm coming from out there straight on. And I got there just as that ball got there, and I hit him with everything I had, put my helmet right in that chest like a form tackle like he's supposed to. And we fell down on that ground down there, and the ball went off over here, and I was hurting from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. But I had given my best shot. And every other time when I call them defenseless like that in pro football and you give them your best shot, they have to come get them on a stretcher. So I kind of looked up to see where that stretcher was coming from, and I didn't see no stretcher. I felt that movement, that pile up there by me, and I heard this voice say, Larry, how's your wife and family? I surrendered to Larry Zonka right then. You know, that was 1971. That's been 25 years ago. If he came in that door back there, I'd make y'all a new door over here. Because every time I fooled with Larry Zonka, I was the one that got hurt. So I surrendered. But isn't that the way it is with alcohol? How many of us have ever hurt alcohol? Hell, I never could drink enough to put them working a second shift down at the plant, Jim. I don't know. I don't know how we would hurt that stuff, you know. But we're the ones that always get hurt. But you know, when I got here and those old timers got me on their wing and they told me that I'd be restored to pride and dignity. And that's all I ever wanted in life. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what got me so enthused about this program. But on drive up here today, I was thinking about enthusiasm. What is enthusiasm? What makes a person enthused? There's so many things that make me enthused about this program, this fellowship, and this love that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous today that I couldn't possibly tell you. But I know some of the results of it. I know what I have to do as a result of being enthused about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to tell the truth. You see, last night at our home group, we had a meeting, and we had a young chairperson. He asked that old question, Has anybody got a topic? Well, of course, one guy had a topic. He'd already had a few drinks, too, before he got the topic, I think. But, I mean, he put something out there on the floor that probably should have been talked about one-on-one with a sponsor. And, you know, I almost went through the ceiling. And I knew then, to be enthused about Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to tell them the truth, no matter how bad it hurts you or how bad you want they what they think of you. So I had to be the bad guy. And I had to tell this young man, this is not a group therapy. This is not an amateur psychology or psychiatrist night. This is our lives we're talking about. This is Alcoholic Anonymous. If you need Hunkadore Anonymous, you're going to have to go two or three doors down the streets to find it, because you're not going to find it in Alcoholic Anonymous. Stuff happens. Stuff happens in your life. But that pride and dignity that those old timers talked about. You know, I wouldn't trade my life today with anybody I've seen. People know me. People know who I am. I've got the pride and dignity to walk down the streets of whatever town I happen to be in and look people in the eye. And that's all I ever wanted from the time I got up on this earth. I'd like to leave y'all with what I always like to say. I thank God our Father, and above all, our friend, for lifting us out of the life we were in, for standing us up and letting us know that life's never over until He lets go, for our great program of truth and concern for our brother, for our book, our fellowship, and our love for one another, our thanks we offer. But in deep gratitude, we pray for His gift of life, ours for today. Thank you, and God bless everybody.